Dear Professor Rudy Beckers, dear family members, colleagues and students, ladies and gentlemen. Now, Professor Rudy Beckers is a graduate from this university. We're proud of that. Interestingly enough, the main conclusion from his thesis 17 years ago was that the European policy has had little factual influence on the success of standards that have eventually become successful. Now, that's an interesting observation. All that work and little impact. It seems that from that moment on, his career has been directed towards improving the effectiveness of international standardization processes. Now, throughout his career, the central drive of Rudy Beckers has been to strike the right balance between technological innovation and entrepreneurial behavior on the one hand, and the collective needs of society on the other hand. And in the arena of standardization and intellectual property rights, with tech giants like Apple, Samsung, Google, Facebook, no longer Philips, the stakes are very high. To prevent winner-takes-all scenarios and to guarantee fair access to the telecommunication technologies, the work of academics, like Rudy Beckers, is absolutely crucial.
Rudy Beckers recently gave his inaugural lecture as full professor at the Eindhoven University of Technology. We spoke to him about the importance of standardization in ensuring healthy technological advancement, about the role of policymakers in ensuring transparency and fairness in standardization, and about his research providing evidence of discrimination against foreigners in the Chinese patenting office.
We are very privileged to host a professor in this international standing and with such a passion for his students. Rudy, the floor is yours.
Thank you. What are the values and the problems with our patent system? On the positive side, we have a patent system that allows for specialization. It allows companies that totally focus on developing new technologies without the need that they actually commercialize all the products with it. It created basically a market for technology where you cannot trade only factual products, but also a market for knowledge and ideas that can be traded via licenses. And arguably, with the patent system, we also have a system with a consistently higher level of innovation in society, but we economists are not even so sure that is actually right. We do know about the negative sides, I can tell you. On the negative side, we see a world in which innovation is more and more small and in incremental steps, and each of these steps get patented. And when somebody creates a new product, it typically requires that it gets license and permission for all these different steps, tens, hundreds, or thousands, or even more. It is estimated that a modern laptop computer covers about 250,000 to 300,000 patents. And you go and negotiate with all these owners. Economists have characterized this as a patent thicket or even an innovation tax. So the patent system actually might be reducing economic growth.
There's an argument that standards create well-functioning markets, potentially even in dynamic areas full of innovation. If one thinks about it, it's almost counterintuitive to think that you can impose on the innovation process standards. So in what way is standardization helpful?
Well, I think standardization is helpful in many ways. And I think one important note to make here that you don't have to impose standards. Companies will understand by themselves if they build something which is isolated from the rest of the world, which is standalone, which does not allow enter connectivity or interoperability with the rest of the world. That's a dead end. Companies in themselves, I think, already should feel and actually do feel in practice, you know, the need and the desire to link to standards, to link to the rest of the world. So it's not so much that we need to oppose standards. And we can also see that many successful standards which are being developed, everybody wants to be on the table. Almost nobody chooses to stay out of it. Maybe there are exceptions there. Maybe a Sony with a PlayStation does take a particular choice and stay out of a harmonization game. But these are really the exceptions. Generally speaking, smart firms with good firm strategies in this field, I mean, they really voluntarily want to be involved in standard and don't feel that it's imposed upon them.
For an outsider, just explain how this process works, this process of harmonization and standardization. Does everyone indeed practically get to sit at the table, even the smaller players?
Not everybody gets there. Let's first see what type of principles we generally would like to adopt here. And these principles are often worded as something we called open standards. A process is open standards if it meets certain criteria. We also might have things that are not open standards. There might be two companies sitting together and just doing something with the two of them together without involving anybody else. It could result in a standard. That is not an open process. In contrast, most of the current standardization processes are considered open, and open means a number of things. And one of them is that everybody with an interest should be able to be potentially involved in it and all the relevant stages in making such a standard. It also means that standard would need to be transparent, that people can see the outcome, can access the content of the standard. And then you might say, isn't that totally logical? But it's not. Actually, a colleague of mine, Kay Sturman of Tilburg University, tried to make a very strong case that standards that are even mandatory by law in the Netherlands, like electrical wiring in buildings, if you build a house, those standards should be available at no cost, is the argument that Kay Sturman made. Unfortunately, a Dutch judge decided otherwise, and so that means that even such essential standards, it's not obvious, it's not trivial that everybody has access to them. So I think that's an interesting question in itself.
And it touches on the area of policymaking. So what's the role of policymakers in this at a national level as well as, for instance, a regional European-wide level?
Okay, there are several roles I think that the policymakers can and do often take. Always thinking from the general interest of the public. I mean, these companies are already there and they will take care of their own interest. As a policymaker, you want to make sure that this process of standardization is a pro-competitive process and not an anti-competitive process. I mean, at the moment, we put 10 companies together and let them decide together on the direction of a technology. I mean, you could also call it collusion. But still, we think if we do it in the right way and if we do it in a way with open standards, as I just said, then the pro-competitive forces are much bigger than the anti-competitive forces. And that's why regulators allow companies to do so, the kind of activities that otherwise will be forbidden by competition law. So that's one role of policymakers. I think another role of policymakers, and that's a bit more difficult, is to realize that not all those stakeholders that have interest in it are actually sitting on the table. For smaller companies, it will be hard to free the resources and to gain up the knowledge and experience to be actually part of the process, to go there all the time, to know how to play the game. It's a rather complicated thing. And so that means that some part of the stakeholders can perfectly express themselves and do have all these resources and are influential in giving direction to the process. Other types of stakeholders are absent or much less effective in doing so. And I think in a general sense, it's also the role of regulators basically to keep an eye on that and to ensure that standardization processes don't take a turn that we don't want them to take.
You are involved in an advisory capacity at a European-wide level. Given what you've just said, do you think the European policymakers and regulators are doing a good job? And there's the policy, but then there's also the enforcement and the execution of that.
Well, they're working terribly hard at that. What we've seen in the last few years, there have been a number of years where studies have been conducted on behalf or commissioned by, for example, the European Commission. We learned quite a bit, I think, from that whole range of studies. I've also been myself in contributing to those. Then in the last 2 years, it became clear that the European Commission was going to issue a so-called communication on that, a document. And such a communication is of high value. Everybody understands that this really, you know, signals where the Commission is going to be going. And in the year until the moment that this communication was published, we've seen an unprecedented amount of lobbying going on by big companies in Europe and also some in the US, by representatives of small companies. I think we've never seen before such a intensive lobbying in this field of technology as we've seen in the last year. It went to all the types of the extremes, basically. And also within the European Commission, views are not necessarily the same. There are DGs that have different views, that have a different focus, either on competition policy or more from the perspective of growth of industry. These are not necessarily the same interest. So it turned out to be extremely hard for the Commission to actually get to this communication, to agree internally, given this external and internal powers that we're playing. But they did so last November, the last day of November last year, they issued that communication. It answers quite a few questions. Certainly, it also does not answer a number of questions that people were eager to hear about, particularly to hear to think that they were right in the arguments that they were bringing forward. But the communication definitely brings us a step forward in terms of achieving, for example, transparency. And that is one of the big items on the table, transparency relevant for startup, for small companies. This is definitely something that the Commission now made clear that this should greatly improve. And we hope to see in the next years how this transparency is going to be improved. And it's also a personal ambition of me to contribute to that process as well myself.
You're also contributing to that process in a completely different sphere, in the academic sphere. So you were an architect in redesigning the bachelor's program at TUE and broadening the curriculum to bring in aspects of standardization and patenting. I would imagine it was an arduous process. Would you say it was a success? And how have you prepared your students for real life?
Okay, well, I would first like to answer your question by saying that this was not an isolated process either. This was part of a general understanding at my university some 6-7 years ago that if we wanted to be successful as a university in, say, 20-30 years from now, we really had to think deeply about the type of students that we're training. What is the skill set? What is the market expecting of them? And the market is expecting people with excellent technical knowledge coming out of a technical university, but also people that are able to reflect on what they do, that are able to collaborate, are able to work interdisciplinary with people from other fields, people that have skills in writing, in communicating, in going across boundaries. So we set up a much wider program, basically, in trying to achieve that, a program which is called the Bachelor College, was like a total overhaul of all the bachelor studies we have. They all disappeared, and this new study came instead of it. And I'll tell in a moment a little bit more about the part that I'm contributing there. Going to your question, is this a success? Well, of course, always depends on the definition of what a success is. But I think it's fair to say that we had for several decades, we had like a steady enrollment of about 1,000 students per year. And since we underwent that change, we've grown to 2,500 students. We had like a massive growth in enrollment, also compared to other technical universities, I believe to a large degree also to the program that we've developed and making it attractive in that sense for students. Now, when it comes specifically to what my contribution is there, we've got a different topics that students can choose from. One of them is then a topic about patterns and standards, the thing that I'm interested in. And what I really try to get across to students is that these standards and all these patterns play really a pivotal role in understanding whether technology actually gets used in society. A pivotal role in what companies really do in R&D. What are their directions? How do they negotiate together what the direction in an industry is? And making a product that is technological superior, that's a fantastic thing to do, but that's far from a guarantee that it's going to be a successful product. There's so many other factors that eventually going to determine whether people are actually going to use it, whether societal problems are going to be addressed by your technology. And patterns and standards are two important phenomenon, I think, in not the only one, but two important phenomenon there. And we really hope that we create richer students that leave this university with a set of understanding and knowledge that's going to serve them in whatever they're going to do in their future career.
Your quote, inventions are not yet innovations, and innovations do not automatically have an impact on society. That's profound.
Yeah, okay. I thought it to be a nice kind of tagline because, especially in an institute like this, I mean, a lot of people talk about innovation and talk about grand societal challenges and impact and whatever. But the mere understanding what the difference between these things really is not as widespread as you would hope to be. I mean, an invention, that's clear. That's when you contribute something to technology that wasn't already there. I would call that an invention. The word innovation by definition also means usage. It means there's take up by users. There's been adoption processes. People have made choices. Companies have made choices to integrate the technology into products or not, etc. That's really significantly more than just an invention. I mean, only a fraction of all the invention in the world lead to factual innovation. And then when we think about grand societal challenges, what we're facing now in Europe and elsewhere in the world are big challenges in terms of sustainability, in terms of mobility, demographics, and health. Many of these challenges and problems we have right now are also the result of technology, let that be clear. Fossil fuel, for example, fueled a lot of these problems. But then there's also a big belief that we now, as engineers, can contribute to future solutions to these problems. And so I was just talking about inventions and innovation, but then you need a third thing, impact. It needs to be used on such a scale and such a direction, a positive direction, that it would actually help in the context of such grand societal challenges. And that's the reason why I like the tagline that you just read out, because in the end, what we should be contributing at the university is really the impact in the end. And I'm happy to see we, just 2 weeks ago, the executive board of this university published its future strategy called Expedition 2030. And it starts from the core concept of having impact and contributing these societal challenges. And then we need to make sure that we're not only good at, you know, superior technologies, but also all these other things that come in play that I was talking about.
Is this process a global one? So are you looking at the European-wide level? How does the US or Asia fit into that?
It's almost always a global process now. The times where important technologies were different between regions really lies behind us. And we had that a few decades ago. You would see for technology, we really have the Japanese variant of a technology. You would have the American and the European. I think that's less and less the case, even if there are any left at all, basically, where you see this as a regional-only development. China tried that. China tried incredibly hard, and they call that indigenous innovation. They tried for many years to create their own standard, preferably also standards for which the patents were with Chinese companies. It was a total failure. Not only was there hardly any take-up in the market, even by big Chinese companies, even if they tried to mandate these standards on the market. They had their own standard for 3G communication. They mandated it on all the parties. But even then, the parties often refused to pick it up. And then on top of it, they even failed to get the Chinese patents into that. And they found out that most of these indigenous standards were mostly built on foreign technologies anyway. So what we actually saw as the outcome of the Chinese process is those companies that have resisted these Chinese-only standards, and those were Huawei and ZTE, finally now they're the biggest player in the world. And China has turned around and basically now has focused itself on the outside world instead of China only. So also in China, we already one phase further in that. One of the recent studies that I did was actually asking ourselves the question, what type of obstacles foreign companies would have operating in China? And the very specific question, whether in the Chinese patent office there would already be forms of discrimination between foreign companies and domestic companies. And if there would be such discrimination, it would be very worrisome, because one of the most fundamental principles of patent law is that you cannot distinguish between your own citizens and foreign applicants with inventions. And we do actually clearly find such discrimination in the Chinese patent system. You can see such things with individual patents, but for us academics, in at least this field, the big challenge is, can you really come with convincing evidence there? Because a differential outcome, like in this country, that many patents get granted out of a set, and in the other country, that many patents, that does not necessarily mean discrimination. You have differential outcome, but discrimination is something else. There could be many good reasons why there are differential outcomes. Maybe Chinese companies are systematically better or maybe worse in the quality of their inventions. Maybe there's something with the patent attorneys. Not a foreign company has less choice in terms of freedom in patent attorneys than Chinese companies can. And patent attorneys have very different hit rates. There, I can think of many, many different explanations that could explain differential outcome. And so the task is basically to identify all these possible sources and to control for them and to find like a kind of unique or a very good identification way that you can really pick it out in such a way you can see, no, this can only be explained by discrimination and not any other confounding factor. And that's the big challenge. So finding just patents, you know, which did get granted somewhere and not in patent in China, that's one thing. But really doing a proper study that would allow you to conclude there is discrimination, that is the big step. And that costed us years of work, basically, to do that properly. We hope to be about to publishing it. We have it around many people, particularly at patent offices around the world, are reading it, are feeding us back with comments whether we overlooked anything in our process, etc. And we're very close, I think, to having it out as a paper. Radio for Brainport.